Tokyo Noah, and you're listening to Chicago Bullseye.
We've had some big guests on the Chicago Bullseye before: Sam Smith, Casey Johnson, Kent McDill, Mark from Australia, but none as big and bold as Mark Silverman, a.k.a. Sylvie, half of the greatest broadcasting institution known as Waddle and Sylvie. It's an honor to have you on the Chicago Bullseye, Sylvie. How you doing, my brother?
I'm doing well, but I'm not bigger than Sam Smith. Sam Smith's a Hall of Famer. Grew up reading Sam Smith, love the guy. All those guys that you named are awesome, Casey. Kent McDill's one of the kindest guys out there. And we love Mark in Australia. So that's it's a good flex by you there, saying all the big wigs you've had on.
Yeah, I'd say like Mark from Australia. Love's a little strong, but I'm sure he'll appreciate it. So before we get started on the beloved Bull, I want to just really quickly give us your advice to the youngsters listening. We have a lot of young teenagers listening to this pod who one day want to achieve their dream of radio broadcasting domination. What would you tell them?
I wouldn't know what domination is, but I would question how many teenagers listen. My biggest thing is just work your ass off. You know, if you really follow your dream, but if you really want something, then you know that it's going to take work, just like anything. There are so many people who think they want to be in sports broadcasting or do what I do, and then they're like, you mean I got to work nights, and I got to work weekends, and I got to work holidays, and I got to work more than 40 hours. You know, I may only get paid for this amount, but you want me to work this amount? So I always looked at it as an investment and opportunity, and just worked as much as I could because it was always a dream of mine. So, you know, Waddle was the same way with football. I mean, he earned everything that he got, and I tried to follow the same way with a lot of the athletes that I grew up watching with their work ethic. So that's my advice, is follow your dream, but know it's not going to be easy, but it's going to take a lot of work.
Great advice. Some of that work you referred to occurred when you covered those legendary Bulls teams. What are some of the images, the moments that come to your mind first when you sit back and think about those days?
I always go in chronological order. So like when I was young and I was just talking about working and stuff like that, I was working in 95. I was interning for GN, and then I got hired for like 5 hours a week once I learned, that they knew that I was good enough to work there and report. But even though I was getting paid for 5 hours a week, I was working like 50 hours a week for GN. And then eventually it was like doing morning drive for the Illinois Radio Network at the same time, where I was getting paid there and part time. So I was working like 70 hours a week, and it was just like a dream. Like, I was covering that middling 500 team. Everyone remembers that first year when Scotty and that team almost beat the Knicks in the Eastern Conference semis. But the following year, as they showed in The Last Dance, was just sort of this middling team of 500. They didn't have that same magic as the year before, and they were just an okay team. And I was covering a lot of those games, and no one was really interested in covering them. They were not much to them. And then I just remember the comeback and Michael coming back and thinking, you know, how fortunate I was there at that time and covering the Pacers series. And then I kind of fast forward to, you know, covering the series against the Pacers game, I should say, in his comeback game. And then the series, I always remember the Orlando series when, watching Horace Grant celebrate and beating them.
Yeah.
And then through that, I progressed through GN, got hired full time, and I was on cloud nine. And then the Bulls reached cloud nine, where I was covering them in 96 as a full-time member of GN, and they would win a championship. And just, I mean, there's so many memories. I would always tell my friends, Fred, that it was like, and it was never lost on me then, because I grew up such a big fan of that team, that it was like covering, or what I would think it would be like covering the 27 Yankees, yeah. You know, where you just heard about Babe Ruth and you knew that when you were covering Michael and they're winning 72 games and you were seeing the greatness night in and night out, and then the eventual three-peat again, that you were covering something that people would talk about for years. That was never lost on me.
What member of that team did you enjoy covering or interviewing the most, and which one did you the least enjoy interviewing?
Believe it or not, there was no, like, least on that team. Like, everyone was cool. Everyone was really pretty cool. And, like, the guy I enjoyed the most interviewing was Michael, because I would just sit there and stare at him and say, I can't fucking believe I'm standing next to Michael Jordan. I can't believe I'm asking Michael Jordan a question right now. Yeah. I don't know how well you know the story. Like, one of my successes on how I got hired full time at GN was, when I was still part time, I was hired, like I told you, first intern, then I got paid for 5 hours. Then they were paying me for 35 hours a week, still not full time. So they didn't have to give me benefits, but I was working full time hours. And then they're like, okay, we want to make this a full time gig. You know, we want you to go out to the United Center before the Bulls game and do a 5 o'clock live sports cast and a 6 o'clock live sports cast. So I wasn't just doing a report from the United Center. It was the whole sports cast. Mm-hmm. And, I went into the Bulls locker room for some reason and nothing would usually happen there. And I don't know if like something else was going on, like on the court, but no other beat writers or anyone was in there. And I was alone, like in the Bulls locker room, and Michael would never be out there pregame. But for whatever reason, Michael went to his locker like at 4:30 or whatever it was to go to his locker because he like had a new shipment of Jordans in there.
Yeah.
And he came out and I said to him, hey, Michael, do you have time for a couple minutes? And he looked at me and he said, sure. And I started interviewing him one-on-one.
Oh.
And then eventually some of the media started coming in and then it turned into like a group interview. But when I went on the 505 Sportscast, I basically said, so I'm live at the United Center and I got this one-on-one with Michael Jordan. And I played the first few minutes of it where I got a one-on-one and my bosses couldn't believe it because they're like, who gets a one-on-one interview with Michael?
Yeah.
And like, let alone this 24-year-old kid, I think it was 24 at the time, is getting this one-on-one. And that's how I sort of, they always told me the story. That's how I sort of clinched the job. Is that I got, and again, it's like right place, right time. So like the point of it is for so many reasons, and Michael helped me along my career, even though he didn't really know it, but it was just so surreal to watch him. One of the nicest guys then and one of the nicest guys now is Steve Kerr.
Yeah.
Steve Kerr was always cool with his time. Steve Kerr too, after one of the championships, I think it was after the 97 championship, recorded my answering machine message. Like, back in the day when you had an actual machine and you actually had that micro cassette, I recorded him with my microphone and I said, hey, Steve, do you mind? You know, I knew him fairly well then. I go, do you mind recording my out message for my answer machine? And it was something to the effect of, hey, this is Steve Kerr of the Chicago Bulls. I've gotten to do a lot of great things since I've hit that big shot. I've been a grand marshal at parades. I sign autographs wherever I go, but there's been no bigger honor than leaving this message for Mark. So leave a message at the beat.
That is great. I never heard Kurt, either of these stories. Wow.
Yeah. So Kurt did that and Luke Longley did one for me too. So it was still back in the day where there was enough. There wasn't like sworn. I mean, it got huge media contingents in the finals and stuff, but it's still like on an everyday basis. And in those days I covered every practice and every game at home, so they got to know me okay as far as knowing my face and trusting me, and you know, they were all really good to me.
So I loved The Last Dance. I think you did too, but I was really frustrated with the subsequent attacks on MJ, you know, from multiple parties, whether it be Hodges, Craig Hodges, or Pippen or Grant. Did you feel the same way about the fallout, and don't they realize how much they benefited from playing with the GOAT? What say you?
Yeah, I think they all do. I think they do, yes. I think there was jealousy then, and I think there's jealousy now. I think Horace Grant would look at it and say, well, it's the same thing as when I played. You know, this is about give the ball to MJ and sort of get out of the way. And, yeah, they would throw me in every now and then for a good line, like he had that really good line about the Pistons, how they were straight-up bitches or something like that.
Yep.
I forget what the line was, but you know, and everyone would play a role, and every now and then they'd go to Pippen or they'd go to Phil, but it was the Michael show. And I, that's what it, like, to me, the way I just summed it up was, if you had 10 episodes and like you had 10 hours of broadcasts, who do you want to hear the most from? You want to hear the most from the greatest athlete of all time.
Exactly.
So, so like, I just think all of it is, you know, it might, look, Michael's arrogant, and Michael could be really, really hard on them. We know all that stuff, though, and I think that came out, and a lot of them vocalized it, and it wasn't always like a fairy tale, but I think it painted a good picture as to sort of how there was always drama around that team, but they were still good enough to overcome and win six.
Yeah, I mean, Michael's impacted my life. He's impacted your life. I'd argue he's impacted more people in the city of Chicago than any human being. So it's I think it's ludicrous for him to get any criticism, but, you know, I digress. Noah, number one pick in 2007. Rose in 2008. Taj Gibson in 2009. Jimmy Butler in 2011. Obviously, in 2010, the Bulls had to trade their number one pick to get that carcass of Heinrich off the roster. But for 4 out of 5 years, the Bulls had 2 first-team All-NBA. Butler made All-NBA. Is that stretch from 2007 to 2011 the greatest stretch for any GM, five-year stretch, in Chicago sports history?
This is when I DM'd you whether I could swear on this or not. And I'm like, fuck no. But look. Here's what I... Look, during those years, as you know, because you've listened to the show, those were the years that I really did back the Bulls front office. And that's why I backed them during the Tibbs fallout, because at that time I trusted them. And that's a great five-year run. The greatest of five-year run in Chicago sports history, I would stop short on that, what Jim Finks was able to do with the Bears and some of the picks that he made in the early 80s. To set up that 85 Bears team. I mean, come on, you go through the list.
Yeah.
It's incredible what he was able to do. But look, that's some greatness right there. I mean, you know, Rose was destined to be a Hall of Famer. At 9, everyone laughed at the Bulls for taking Joakim Noah. Jimmy Butler at 30 was as good of a value pick as you can make. The way I always sum up about Pax was, Pax set the table as well as anyone could. He was really, really good at his job, and he could set up the table and serve you a really good meal, but it would never end well. Something would always go wrong with the meal, whether the dessert was screwed up or whether there was a fly in your drink, whether you ran out of wine. Like, I mean, like the Dwayne Wade stuff. When in his first draft, he identified Dwayne Wade. He wanted Dwayne Wade. He couldn't finish. He didn't say to himself, trade Danielle Marshall, get Dwayne Wade, never look back. Yeah. When they set the table for that 2010-11 team, great team they assembled, they couldn't finish with a shooting guard to pair with Derrick Rose while he was healthy. Derrick gets hurt, and then you have the fallout with Tibbs. You identified Tom Thibodeau. That's another thing that you got to put in there in that stretch. Not only did he have that great draft, those great drafts, and really did a great job setting it up to go in and for the first guys to believe in Tibbs and to give him the job when no one gave Tibbs a job after 20 years of being an assistant, that was really good by the Bulls. How did it finish? It finished poorly. Now, we could have that conversation, and I know you feel about Tibbs. You don't like him at all. But the point is it finished poorly, and they had a lot to do with that. And that's what, and just like this rebuild, it ended poorly. That was always my criticism with Pax. He could identify. He was really, really good at his job, and I respect him. But in the end, he couldn't finish.
Yeah, I will say, though, you know, the Bulls did have a shooting guard on that roster. His name was Kyle Korver, but Tibbs decided to play a bum like Keith Bogans ahead of him and keep Korver to 20 minutes. He subsequently went to Atlanta and became an all-star. So I blame that on St. Tibbs. You know, like, he gets a big pass for a lot of stuff. But
you think if Kyle Korver's the Bulls' starting shooting guard, he could, like, I still think he was, maybe he could have played more, but I still think Kyle Korver is a role guy. And especially with Tibbs, the way he built his defense, and he got better defensively. But I just think that that they needed something more dynamic. Like if Rip Hamilton was a few years younger when they got him, it would have been better, but they just, you know, they just couldn't go over the top into the luxury tax and get creative and go after that guy and say, now is the time to pounce. Instead, they always held onto their assets. Oh, well, we got this. We're going to eventually get that Charlotte pick. Oh, we're eventually going to get the Sacramento pick. And none of them turned out to be what they thought they would be.
Yeah, I'm begging you, Sylvie, go watch the Eastern Conference Finals of 2011 again and ask yourself why Korver hardly played. It's inexcusable that they basically played a zone defense against Rose. They had no one extend the floor. I watched it over again recently. I was appalled at the coaching.
And why would you torture yourself?
Well, I try to learn, become better, learn from my mistakes. And this is part of the reason I think, you know, I think it's a good idea for fans to go back and look. And you'll have a drastically different opinion of Tom Thibodeau after watching that series. I felt the Bulls were the better team. I really believe that. But, you know.
I know it. And I think a lot more of Tibbs than you do. But Tom Thibodeau was stubborn to a fault. Yes. And Tom Thibodeau had his belief, and he wasn't open-minded. They wanted him to play a little more fast-paced. He was stubborn. They wanted him to be a little more open-minded and be available around the facility a little more. The minutes thing in context, like we always talk, not the number of minutes, but knowing when to give guys the hook and everything like that. But he was very, very stubborn in his belief, and he wasn't perfect for sure. So look, there are some good points to that. He would not move off of different things and bring in different guys, even though they thought, we thought and knew that they could help a little bit more.
So rapid fire to close this up. I know we only got a few minutes. If Rondo remains healthy in 2017, did the Bulls beat the Celtics?
No, it's one of your worst takes.
And they dominated the first two games of that series. Why not? Why do you feel you didn't like, notice the delta between him and the bums following him, Rondo?
I thought it was a Bulls issue throughout that era of not being able to close out. Again, like I was talking about packs, but like it wasn't just a Rondo thing to me, whether it was going up 1-0 on the Heat in game one and not being able to win another game the rest of the way and lose 4-1 and blowing that lead on your home court in game five and not forcing a game six in 11. The Cleveland series, when you're up 2-1 and having the Cavaliers up against the ropes in that third quarter with a banged up Kyrie Irving, and then you let them off the hook.
Well, Gasol,
you know,
got hurt. I
just feel like that was a problem with some of those teams that, you know, they would give us a lot of hope with success early in the series, but they were seven game series for a reason. And I didn't believe in that team. You believed in that team more. I didn't believe in that team, and I wouldn't give them the benefit of the doubt.
Knowing what you know today, do you still make the Butler trade?
No, not knowing what I know today.
Okay.
I don't know if you remember, my theory then was, what I used to yell at Waddle all the time was, and I liked Jimmy more than most people did. Maybe I still overrated him, but I still thought more of Jimmy. My thing that I preached was Jimmy and the kids. I wanted to go in that Dwayne Wade year instead of doing what they did with that, Jimmy and the kids. The next year after that was a disaster. I still wanted to do Jimmy and the kids. You get that player, find as many kids as you can. Maybe you develop some, and if you don't, you're bad enough where you're back in the lottery, and maybe you get a star that way to pair with Jimmy. But, you know, knowing what kind of league this is, knowing now what kind of pull Jimmy could have, knowing that Lauri Markkanen hasn't developed like we thought he has, knowing that this is all about knowing in hindsight, knowing that the lottery balls didn't bounce your way. I mean, 777, you keep framing that as something good and like destiny for the seventh championship. But knowing everything I know now, I keep Jimmy, and I would try and try and try in different ways.
Last question. If Boylan is still head coach of the Bulls to start the 2020 season, you will blank.
Shit my pants.
I hope we're both wrong on that one. I agree.
I mean, like I know people wanted me to say boycott. I don't want to boycott starved for sports to be back. And I have young kids now who love going to those games. I just hope that Jerry, Michael, and especially Karnishevis and Eversley are smart enough to know that you can't start a new era without completely starting a new era. And that's a coach. And no matter what Boylan is trying to sell them on, I think it would be a mistake on Karnishevis's part in two ways. Like, if people want to say, well, look, what can you do if your owner wants you to keep the coach? Well, if I'm Karnishevis and I know my arrow is up, I don't take the job. I said that about Ryan Pace. I mean, if you're not going to let me hire my coach and I'm interviewing you as much as you're interviewing me, then I say, look, I don't want the job. This is something, here's my plan. And if he's allowed Boylan to win him over and wants to give him a chance, now I question Karnishevis's basketball knowledge.
Yes.
Because I do think they're smart and I do think they're going to make good decisions. I can't in the right mind. I'm hoping that A, this is a COVID related thing, that B, the guys they want to hire and have relationships with are inside the bubble and they know that they've got their hands full to begin with, dealing with a pandemic, dealing with the team inside of the bubble, dealing with the team trying to win a championship, and they don't want to disrupt any of that. And they're just waiting for, you know, all of this to settle in. And when they do, they'll pounce and they'll make their move. So,
Sylvie, I can't thank you enough for jumping on. You're truly one of us. You're a local kid who really made it big in the city. And I really feel you're the only host that really loves the Bulls the most. Like, I love everybody on ESPN 1000, but I think
Carbon loves the Bulls. I mean,
yeah, but I mean, like, I don't think he loves them more than the Bears. I think deep down, you're the only guy who loves the Bulls the most. Would you concur?
Well, right. Yeah, I mean, like, it was always to me about my first love was the Cubs. But then I got to go to these Bulls games at a very young age because my grandfather was a season ticket holder from the year they were in their first year in 66-67. So, like, he would go to the amphitheater. And then he would take me to the stadium in like 75, 76 when they were, you know, just okay. And they were just coming back. Norm was still there. Jerry Sloan was still there. And then they were going into some dark years. So I grew up with some bad teams and we sat on the floor. And that was like before, like it was cool to sit on the floor. And so I just then started loving basketball. And then once they get Michael, you know, then everything. Like, I loved Orlando Woolridge. I used to go to the Orlando Woolridge radio show when I was a kid. So, yeah, I mean, it's like a lot of kids who grew up going to Soldier Field and had, you know, Bears tickets in their family going back to Wrigley Field. That's how I was with the Bulls. So, yes, like, it's one of my all-time favorite things.
And that's why you're beloved by our fan base. So we were praying for you. We think about you. We listen to you every day. It's got to bring you some solace that there's literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions of fans that, you know, are sending
good
vibes.
Now you're stretching it.
But Sylvie Strong, how do people get those t-shirts?
I bought one already.
But how can we support
get them for
you?
The kids, Fred? They make them in youth sizes too.
Absolutely. I think they have in 2X, which I got it in. So I'm very
and I think we have a contest that we're going to announce soon. So with that, but go to obviousshirts.com, obviousshirts.com. Every proceed goes to the V Foundation, and everything that the V Foundation raises, every cent that they raise, goes to cancer research. So it's a big charity for me, and I'm in a good position because of what the V Foundation did before me, and I want other people to benefit from it if they ever have to go through what I'm going through right now.
Yeah.
So the V Foundation is an awesome spot, and again, like, if you anybody who could buy these shirts, or for your friends, for your kids, whatever. We've raised over $35,000 so far. My goal now is 50 grand. If I could cut a check to the V Foundation for 50 grand, that would be a dream come true.
Awesome, man. Thanks, Sylvie.